This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
A clash of civilizations between Europe and the forces of Islam is brewing. Many Europeans are very concerned about the decades-long incursion of Muslims into the continent and the transformative effect this is having on European culture, as well as the dangers being posed by violent Muslims and Islamist terrorists. Well, a lightning bolt sign of just how profound the concern is took place in France this week. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, 20 French generals and 1,500 other individuals, I think largely military personnel in different roles, signed an open letter addressed to the French President Emmanuel Macron, almost basically implicitly threatening a coup if France didn't, or if he didn't do more to combat radical Islam. The letter says the hour is grave. France is in jeopardy, threatened by several mortal dangers. One of those dangers that it talked about is kind of this left-wing woke culture. But the main thing that it focused on was the danger posed by radical Islam. The letter said, "We remain soldiers of France and cannot, in the present circumstances, remain indifferent to the fate of our beautiful country." It said that France is disintegrating with the Islamists of the hordes of the suburbs, who are detaching large parts of the nation and turning them into territory subject to dogmas contrary to our constitution. The open letter was published in the Valeurs Actuelles. It's a right-wing news magazine. But it went on to say that France was heading to civil war. It said unless something is done, there will be civil war with radical Islam, and the military is going to have to step in before then to stop this from happening. It said, enough procrastination. The hour is serious. The work is colossal. Do not waste time and know that we're ready to support policies that will take into consideration the safeguarding of the nation. We can see, it says, there is no more time to procrastinate. Otherwise, imminent civil war will put an end to the growing chaos and the deaths for which you will be responsible. And the deaths for which you will be responsible will amount to thousands.
So what does it say that you have these military leaders? This is not a group of people that you would consider from the extreme right in France. This is a group that you would say is probably much closer to representative of mainstream French opinion, that they're willing to come out and make such a strong statement. And what kind of a position does this put Macron in?
Yeah, I think this says something pretty big about French society. I mean, we've been making this point. You can go all the way back to some of the articles we were writing in 2015, 2016, after France had some big terrorist attacks. And we were saying, look, the measures they're taking are not going to stop these attacks. And when they continue, that is going to that's going to change a country. That changes the culture of a country. That changes what is considered acceptable. And that really is especially what you've seen in France. I mean, you had those big attacks several years ago. Since then, there's been a steady kind of drip of quote-unquote small attacks. I mean, I don't think it's ever really accurate to describe a murder or something, a terrorist attack, as small. But attacks at, say, a level that don't necessarily make front-page news in British or American headlines. But they've been having a big impact in France. You had this just days after this letter was published. That was published on April 21st. And then just a couple of days later, April 23rd, you had a terrorist come into a police station and stab a woman to death after shouting Allahu Akbar. And you know, even that, then you had several attacks over in the autumn. You had the fairly famous attack where a Chechen refugee beheaded a teacher for showing pictures of Muslims, you had a Tunisian migrant on October 30th who killed three people at a church in Nice. You've had a steady roll of these attacks, and it's changing France. It's pushing people to vote for the National Front and for this, or it's not called the National Front anymore, but this party that was once considered extreme, that was once considered beyond the pale, you know, maybe you'd have a few older voters would vote for them. That's not the case anymore. You're getting close to a third of millennials, a third of people aged 25 to 34 are voting for this party that, you know, that's French society heading in a direction very different to the way you see young people, the direction you see young people heading in Britain and in America. And it's because of these attacks. It's because some of these young people have had friends killed in the big attack in 2015, this kind of thing. So, yes, this tells us a lot about French society, that the military leaders feel that they need to say something like this. And it shows that we're seeing a shift, you know, not just in the military, but in all of France.
Emmanuel Macron really does... He's taken measures to try to address this problem. Clearly, there are a lot of people in France who believe we haven't gone nearly far enough. We need to go much, much further. And there is a political opening here. If either Macron has to get far more robust in his response to these kinds of attacks and move France in a direction or to a degree that he has proven so far unwilling to do, or you have the opening for someone to step up and say, I am the answer, I am going to deal with this. And you could see where there would be a whole lot of people in France who would be willing to endorse that kind of a candidate. What's your thought? Obviously, France is a major part of they're really at the heart of Europe. We talk about France and Germany being like the two most pillar nations within the European Union and kind of leading leading Europe going forward. What's your view of how this may unfold, just given this snapshot of France's opinion today?
Yeah, I think you make a fascinating point, going back to what you said at the start there with, you look at what Emmanuel Macron has done already, and I think he has already gone further than what the National Front promised in the last election.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So it shows you how quickly this is moving. He's done more than the extremists, or the ones that are considered extremists, said they were going to do. So yeah, he has done, it's not like he's done nothing. Absolutely. You know, they're kind of banning homeschooling, and they're doing all kinds of things to have government licenses of who can run religious services and this kind of thing. And, you know, there's limits on who can send preachers of any religion. There's a lot of government stepping up in the role of religion under Emmanuel Macron. But going further than what the far right wanted last election is not enough, and is not even enough now for most of mainstream France. So that gives you an idea of how quickly things can continue to shift. And if he does something, if he takes some fairly big moves and then terrorist attacks continue, well, people are just going to keep demanding more and more. And so this whole story is fascinating because it ties together a couple of different prophetic elements that we're watching. You know, we're watching for this clash between, or more than a couple. I mean, we're watching for this clash between Europe and radical Islam. And Daniel chapter 11 talks about Europe confronting this king of the north confronting the king of the south. And we have a booklet, The King of the South, that shows how this king of the south is referring to radical Islam led by Iran. So we're expecting Europe to confront that. And it will be a German-led European Union. But France, like you said, is absolutely going to play a big role in that. And they do have quite a widespread military presence in the Middle East and in North Africa. We also have this forecast that Europe is going to become more religious itself, that you're going to have a European Union led by a church. And Revelation chapter 17 talks about that. And you see how these two then tie in very closely together. As Europe confronts radical Islam, that kind of accentuates their Catholic identity. And we're seeing this in France with people kind of rallying around the Catholic Church as you have some of these attacks take place at churches. And the Bible talks about Europe being led by a strong man overall, and then multiple strong men under him, you know, autocratic government, not a democracy. And again, as Europe responds to these terrorist attacks by sacrificing freedom in exchange for more security, and the government taking more and more measures that would have before been seen unthinkable. You're banning homeschooling, getting more involved in what's allowed to be taught, what you can say, these kind of things. You can see how it's pushing Europe in that direction too, into this more autocratic direction. So you see that this kind of this movement in Europe tying into a whole range of critical prophecies, and you see the whole prophetic landscape for Europe kind of coming into focus.
Well, our trumpet writer, Josue Michels, this was the subject of his trumpet brief on Wednesday. The title of the article that is now up at thetrumpet.com, French Retired Generals Threaten Military Coup to Deal with Islamism. Go and read that, and it does go into some detail on some of the prophecies that Richard was just talking about. We will definitely keep a close eye on what is happening here, a rapidly developing situation in France. Obviously, President Macron is going to have to deal, he's going to have to address what these generals raised in this letter, and so we may well see more developments in the very near future there in France. Thank you very much for that, Richard. On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden gave his first address to Congress, and it was filled with what we have come to expect from this administration, statements that, to put it euphemistically, aren't on good speaking terms with reality. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
This was a State of the Union-style speech that that Joe Biden gave on Wednesday, basically summarizing his accomplishments in his first 100 days in office. And I will give him this. He's definitely been busy those first 100 days. He started off the speech basically taking credit for vaccination programs and job creation programs that he inherited from the Trump administration, although that's probably pretty typical behavior for most presidents to take credit for some of their predecessors' accomplishments. But after that, he really got into the meat of the speech, which is what he's trying to do differently from the Trump administration, and covered a lot of ground, covered everything from the COVID relief packages to gun control to the migrant crisis to voter ID laws to Medicare to deficit spending to taxes, crime, and bipartisanship, and pretty much gave the wrong answer on all of those issues. Like you said, the National Review described this as intermittently connected with reality.
Yeah, you know, I would like to get into some of the details of what he said, but what's remarkable is how unanimous the press seems to be and completely on board with what he's saying. He's making these statements that are just demonstrably false, and the press is completely going along with it. We had the montage on the Trumpet Daily this morning where all of these all the people in the press were saying that this was a bold speech. It was a ambitious. He's courageous for having proceeded forward with all of these plans, and he is doing a lot. But the argumentation that he's using to underpin these moves that he's making is really suspect.
Right. I mean, the National Review, they pointed out with their critique, focusing in on his starting off with his gun control plan. He's looking for a 10-year ban on assault weapons that's almost assuredly unconstitutional. Congress did cite a similar ban in 1994 that's actually kind of called like the Joe Biden Act because he was instrumental in getting it put forward. But it was part of a bigger crime package that the Clinton administration puts through that like increased the number of police, cracked down on drug trafficking, increased our prison population by like arresting a ton of criminals and putting them in jail, and banning assault weapons. And so now the Biden administration's basically coming back and saying, like, oh, yeah, all that we did back in 1994, it reduced the murder rate in America because we cracked down on the assault weapons, not because we arrested drug traffickers or supported the police. They're like, we don't want to do that part. Forget about the police. Just take away the assault weapons. But again, as they point out, it's like they've had, this is obviously an experiment America did for 10 years. And so it's been thoroughly studied and said, actually, no, the increasing the police is what reduced the crime. Taking away the assault weapons did practically nothing just because so much of America's gun crime is driven by handguns, that the percentage of people killed with the type of weapons he's talking about banning is rather minuscule. And so when they looked at that, the National Review has links to the studies saying that's not doing what he says it's doing. The Biden administration is pushing those reforms for another reason and peddling talking points that have been thoroughly debunked. Similar with the migrant crisis story, he's now having to reluctantly admit that there's a migrant surge on the border, but he's saying, well, that's all Donald Trump's fault for cutting aid packages to Guatemala, which is something Trump did 2 years ago, and the number of migrants actually went down right after he did that, because he basically told these Central American nations that, like, I'm not giving you aid if you don't keep your people there, and it worked, and it worked all the way up until the Biden administration stopped doing that. And so, like I said, claiming that, like, okay, what we're dealing now is because of that is, like, just a blatant lie. Because you can see the fruits from it. Similar with, like, the voter ID laws. He's saying, like, all these Americans want to do away with these photo ID laws. But if you look at any poll, it's like, actually, no, 75% of Americans support photo ID to vote.
Yeah.
It's about 25% of Americans, and more importantly, about 200 wealthy CEOs
right.
who don't want that, which is why Biden's pushing that in this speech.
Well, I think that's kind of the point underpinning so much of this, is that they are pitching this as if the American people are just absolutely on board with everything that he's saying, that these are popular proposals and steps that he's taking. But the reality is very, very different. And yet again, you have all of the press right on board with this and acting like this is, the most popular president in history.
Right. I mean, for the migrant crisis and the voter ID laws, they have pretty good polls showing that 75% of Americans support voter ID laws, even though Joe Biden doesn't. Similar percentage, 75% of Americans think something needs to be done to increase border security, even though Joe Biden doesn't. I don't have the poll numbers on the gun control, but the gun sales statistics kind of bear out that there's a whole bunch of Americans, a majority of Americans, who don't agree with his assault weapons ban either. So, these are not popular policies. They're something that you've got this vocal minority going up against a silent majority to fundamentally transform the nation. That's the article we have set for the show notes today is from our last Trumpet print edition. Actually, there's two in there. One from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, on America Has No Helper, and then from our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, on A Nation-Destroying Presidency. But that Nation-Destroying Presidency article goes through a lot of the types of things we've been talking about today that were written after, like, Joe Biden's, like, 2 or 3 weeks in office. Now it's 100 days, so it's that much worse. But just going through just how all these policies are really tearing down America, and then with a hefty subhead as well on Daniel 8:12 about this dual prophecy about the truth being cast down to the ground in the end time. And it definitely, if you, I don't know how many of our listeners watched that congressional address, but the truth was definitely on the ground in the carpet someplace.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, that you see both sides of that. You see the policies that are destroying the nation, and you see the truth being completely cast aside and trampled on. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. Go check out those articles from that new, I guess that was 2 issues ago, America Has No Helper and A Nation-Destroying Presidency. We appreciate that. The Palestinian Authority isn't the most democratically minded entity in the world, but in January, they actually called for a parliamentary vote, first one since 2006. Well, anyone who thought this might mark some progress for Palestinians had their hopes dashed this week. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, the decision was made just overnight on Thursday by Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority that has been in power since 2004, I believe it is, and that was a 4-year term that has been extended over and over again. As you mentioned, he decided that the May 22nd election, the Palestinian legislative elections, would be postponed or delayed indefinitely. Now, the reason for his postponement, he said, was that Israel was forbidding Palestinians from being able to vote in East Jerusalem. And because of that, and because he said Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the Palestinians, that he would not allow this vote to go forward. Now, what's really unsurprising about this is that most commentators over the past week or so, and even going back to when these were announced in January, really did see it as a highly probable thing that it would be delayed, or there would be a reason that Mahmoud Abbas would find to halt these Palestinian legislative elections from going forward. And the fact that he would blame Israel for this, and talking about the East Jerusalem situation as kind of the scapegoat for stopping these elections is not surprising at all. It could have been anticipated, and it was anticipated. Now the question then becomes, why did he do it? If it's not a real thing that he's really upset that the 6,000 or so Palestinians that this would affect in East Jerusalem, there's many East Jerusalemites and the Palestinians that can vote, and that all of them can vote. Israel just doesn't want voting booths set up right inside its capital for a different state, as they would see it, the state of Palestine's election. So that's what's going on there. But the reason Mahmoud Abbas doesn't want to go to a vote right now is that he is extremely unpopular with the Palestinian people. And even the New York Times pointed out this, quote, "The postponement also served another purpose. Mr. Abbas was concerned that if the election went ahead, his party, Fatah, might lose ground to two Fatah splinter groups," according to a Palestinian official and Western diplomat as well. And Israel, of course, was concerned that it would be Hamas that would gain more power inside these legislative elections.
It's the New York Times talking about this, which is it shows you just how clear and obvious it is that what's motivating this decision. Why did he call it to begin with? And what does this mean for the PA going forward?
Well, I think he called it because pressure is increasing on him extremely. He is getting older. I think he's 80 or so. And he does not have a leader groomed to take over the Palestinian Authority after him. And so pressure is increasing for him with his European funders and donors to go ahead and have an election. And so this hasn't been the first time that he's announced an election that hasn't gone forward. However, I will say that just the frustration on the Palestinian street against him is at an all-time high. If this election went forward, it looked like he would have got about 20% of the vote, and that the other two Fatah splinters that have come off from him would have got around the same percentage of the vote, and that the remaining about 40% would have gone to Hamas. So in a legislative election, that means Hamas would be the biggest power inside the next Palestinian body. And so who didn't want this election to happen? He didn't. Mahmoud Abbas didn't. He was going to lose power to either two other Fatah officials or Hamas. So he doesn't want it to happen. Israel doesn't want it to happen as well. And they're happy for the time being to be the scapegoat, because they would rather deal with Mahmoud Abbas than Hamas in power inside the West Bank. And the Europeans probably don't want it to go ahead also, because Mahmoud Abbas is the leader that they know and the leader that they've supported for so long. He is the peacemaker of their, as many European leaders have called him. And so everybody doesn't want this election to go forward apart from the Palestinians. Hamas is rioting or protesting right now in the Gaza Strip. Massive protests going on against Fatah, against Mahmoud Abbas. They're upset. Then you had other officials, that Fatah officials, calling this a coup. That how can one of the most unpopular leaders on the list call off the election right before it takes place, blaming and scapegoating Israel? This is anti-democratic, and we're upset by this. So I think looking forward the next couple of days, we will really see that the Palestinians themselves will show Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone this as a fraud, blaming Israel, and that they are very upset about their inability to have a democratic vote for their legislative bodies. But we'll see just how much power and pressure comes on Mahmoud Abbas to change his mind, given that Israel and also the Europeans are probably happy with the status quo.
Given the mood of the Palestinian street, is it inevitable, and looking at the perspective of Bible prophecy as well, that the Palestinians would become more more radicalized going forward?
Yes, Bible prophecy does say that. We've pointed to a prophecy in Zechariah that talks about how we know that half of Jerusalem is going to actually go over to Palestinian control in an armed uprising. And so this is what we expect. And this is an event that comes directly preceding another couple of events leading to the return of Jesus Christ. So that's why we're so interested in Palestinian politics, because we expect Mahmoud Abbas, somebody that's been there for such a long time, that's enjoying the fruits of Western funding, him and his family. He doesn't look like the power that would want to lead a total armed insurrection against the Israelis. And so we've expected, based on that, a Hamas takeover of the West Bank, this other Palestinian territory that it does not currently control, as opposed to the Gaza Strip. So what we expect then, and what this is going to lead to, is increasing frustration, increasing tension between Fatah and Hamas, and even, I would say, increasing tension between the more extreme parts of Fatah. There, one of the other challenges is Barghouti. He's got 30, the blood of 30 Israelis on his head. He's currently in Israeli prison right now, and he's pulling as much of a vote as Mahmoud Abbas is. And so the Palestinian street is not becoming, let's say, more peace-loving, but they are being pushed to be more frustrated with the current leadership of the Palestinians, which will lead them into a path towards more hardline Palestinian groups, including Hamas, but also more extreme terrorist elements of the Fatah party as well.
Well, if you would like more information about those prophecies that Brent is referencing, look at our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. We'll link to that in our show notes. You can find it in our literature library as well. Thank you, Brent. Two powerhouses of Asia agreed to a meeting that promises to bring them closer together, a development with strong prophetic implications. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced on Wednesday that he and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke over the phone, and they came to a milestone agreement to set up a 2+2 meeting between the foreign and defense ministers of their two countries. So this 2+2 dialogue is something that India has conducted for several years now with a few other countries. It holds these meetings at kind of irregular intervals with Japan, Australia, and the United States. And it's basically just a tool for close coordination of various aspects of their foreign policy and defense policy. But you'll notice that all three of those countries, Japan, Australia, and the U.S., they're all part of the Quad alliance with India. That's the kind of a NATO-like alliance that they've formed to address concerns in the Indo-Pacific. And so they're all three very close partners with India, and that's why they're given these high-level, behind-closed-doors meetings. So Russia will be the first nation from outside the Quad that India is opening this door to. And that is, I think, a very significant gesture for the Indians. It shows just how highly India values its ties with Russia. It shows, I think, just how eager they are to strengthen those ties. And then during the same phone call, Putin also pledged what he called full support to help India with its coronavirus crisis. India right now is, you know, just really struggling. They set a world record yesterday for 360,000 new cases reported in a 24-hour period and 3,300 deaths in one day. So it's just off the charts there. And India has been asking for assistance from other countries, and Russia is now sending oxygen concentrators and ventilators, pharmaceutical products. It's also sending the Sputnik V vaccine. So Modi had just gushing gratitude for all of that. So, yeah, we know that Russia and India have been close partners for many years, but it looks like with this 2+2 meeting now set up, and with a remarkable level of COVID assistance now coming to India from Russia, that partnership will be deepened and expanded and just hitting a new level.
What do you see as the broader implications of Russia and India coming together?
Well, I think a big part of it is that this is a big blow for America's ties with India. You know, that's India is supposed to be a very close friend to the United States. It's an invaluable partner for America, especially in the push to stand up to China. But India has not been nearly as devoted to the U.S. as Washington would like. And that's especially clear when it comes to Russia. The U.S. has been, you know, trying to stop all countries from buying Russian military gear, and India is one of Russia's largest purchasers. And then the U.S. has also tried to convince India to boost interoperability with American forces instead, but India seems to just be steadily declining on those invitations, and it's even risking U.S. sanctions with some of the advanced weapons that it's buying from Russia, such as the S-400 missile defense system. So there have been a lot of questions about India's true loyalties lately, you know, if it were forced to choose between Russia and the United States. And now we have this 2+2 deal set up, and we have Russia also stepping up to help India with COVID. And that's happening at the same time that India has criticized the United States for not helping it more, especially with vaccinations for COVID. So this could all shape up to be just, I think, a really significant blow to U.S.-India relations, and then a big boon to Russia-India relations.
And Russia-Indian relations is prophesied specifically in Scripture.
It is, yes. On Trumpet Hour, we often discuss an army of 200 million soldiers that Bible prophecy says will form in the modern era. We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that goes through all the various Bible passages about this power. The scriptures, and especially a passage in Ezekiel 38, show that this power will be led by Russia. And then that same chapter goes on to list some ancient names for the people that now make up India. That's in verse 5 of that chapter. So we expect all of this to come to pass soon, this army to be formed. And with India now drawing closer to Russia and depending more heavily on Russia, even at the risk of damaging its relationship with the U.S., I think we can see the conditions really being created for India to take its place in that Russia-led Asian bloc.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, treason exposed by a current member of the Biden administration, an actual ballot recount of the 2020 presidential election taking place in an important American county, and more. We will be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A leaked audio tape had an explosive allegation from Iran's foreign minister about the climate czar for the Biden administration. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this story was everywhere this week. It was about Javad Zarif, the longtime foreign minister of Iran and one of the chief negotiators of the nuclear deal, and conversations that he had back about half a decade ago with John Kerry regarding Israel's attacks against Iranian and Syrian forces inside Syria. This was a recording of a conversation that was held just last year in March between Zarif and a Iranian think tank. And the thing that was latched onto by the New York Times and then everybody since was the fact that this is the quote actually from Zarif from that recording. He says, "Kerry told me that Israel had launched 200 strikes against you, that is Iran." And which Zarif then says was the first time that he had heard about this, that Israel was directly blamed for these attacks. And it came from the Secretary of State of the United States. Israel, of course, being the chief ally of the United States in the region, Iran, of course, being the chief enemy of the United States in the region. And yet he had the Secretary of State really going behind Israel's back and showing without any doubt that Israel was behind these attacks, certainly something that a friend wouldn't do, and really does show what Kerry was up to and kind of give another a light to show how strong the relationship was between John Kerry and Zarif in particular, and also the Iranians as a whole. You would expect the Americans to be allies with Israel and acting with Israel as its chief concern. And yet what this tape and other revelations that have come out over the past few years have shown is that the United States was firmly behind Iran in these negotiations rather than protecting Israel's or even Americans' interest as well.
Do you see this as just more evidence of this this trend that we have exposed a lot? Mr. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has talked about a lot just how aligned with Iran the Obama administration is, and that was actually his chief foreign policy objective.
Yes, I mean, you had everyone that was... all hands were on board for this. Joe Biden was there. Samantha Powers was there. Obviously, Secretary Kerry was there. Obama wanted it. Hillary Clinton was involved. One thing that Israeli commentators have brought out is that they're not surprised by this at all. Secretary Kerry was actually telling the Israelis back in early 2013 that there was no negotiations with the Iranians taking place over the nuclear program, that don't worry, Israel, we've got your back. And then it came out a couple months later in November 2013 that was an absolute lie. Yes, there was back-channel negotiations going on with Iran even before the moderates got into power. And all along, the close relationship wasn't between Israel and the United States, but between the Iranians and the United States. Now, I do think there is far more to this story than we even know and even realize right now. The fact that it was leaked by the Iranians, the fact that it went to the New York Times. I think it is important to show that the whole context of this discussion between Javad Zarif and the Iranians, the think tank, was to show that Javad Zarif is a moderate power in Iran. Yes, he might not have much power, but it was Soleimani, it was the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, that was trying to stop the nuclear deal, that wanted to push forward with more overt military actions against Israel and America. And it was us, though we're limited in power, that were saving the world through the nuclear deal. And this is a narrative that is going to be recycled even as we speak, as the Americans are pushing towards a renewed nuclear deal. The New York Times, Biden administration, the Iranians will want the West to think that this is the only option, that these moderates are constraining the harder elements in Iran just like they did in 2015. I think this whole sideshow in a way with Kerry is important, but I don't think it is the major narrative to come out of these tapes that is wanted by the Western press and also the Iranians.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, and you have to just wonder. It seems like John Kerry has always had kind of an odd fascination with and connection to Iran here, and the fact that the United States is right now in the middle of these this effort to reignite the Iran deal. Who are we dealing with here?
Right, and I think this story brings it out very well, and that is that all parties involved, whether it's the United States, John Kerry, and the current administration that's trying to cover for John Kerry right now, saying that Zarif lied. In this recording, it doesn't look to be true. The recording looks to be accurate, and so that's probably not true. But let's say it is. Let's say Zarif is lying. Let's say that Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Kerry didn't say that. Well, then why is the United States negotiating with liars?
Yeah.
Is that a good thing that the United States is doing? Can you have a nuclear deal? Something as serious as a nuclear deal that's meant to constrain Iran's nuclear program, with a bunch of people that you're meant to hold them to their word, which is essentially the deal that's shaping up. It really does make me think of Mr. Fleury's chapter in Great Again, this booklet, where he talks about the original nuclear deal, and he entitled it the most dangerous lie in history. And that's what we see here from the American Antiochus administration, as Mr. Flurry calls it, the Barack Obama administration, and the Iranians. There's lies here, but at the root of it, you do have an attachment between this administration and the Iranians that does come together to, in the end of it, empower a regime to go about its goal of destroying the state of Israel.
Where would you send people for more information?
People can read that chapter. I think it's a wonderful chapter to showcase and really illuminate what's going on even right now, the most dangerous lie in history.
From our booklet, Great Again. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Trumpet readers and listeners know that our editor-in-chief has stated, based on Bible prophecy, that Donald Trump is going to regain the presidency somehow. Well, so far, all efforts to expose and undo the fraud committed in the 2020 presidential election have been ignored or thwarted. A project now underway in Arizona seems to be bucking this trend. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this hand recount in Arizona is probably the best examination of election fraud in the 2020 presidential election to date. The Arizona Republican Party hired four independent contractors to come in and count every single ballot by hand, as well as doing a pretty much a full forensic exam of the voting machines. And so it's going to take a while, probably 2 or 3 months. There's 2.1 million ballots in Maricopa County that they need to go through. So it takes quite some time, but good chance that they'll find something interesting, especially given the reaction, the fuming reaction the Democrats have had against this. Because actually, like last week, the Arizona Democratic Party and the one like member of the board in Maricopa County who was a Democrat came out and did everything they could to put a restraining order on this. The judge eventually ruled that they're like, all right, well, maybe we can delay it a couple days, but the Republicans have already leased the stadium and paid contractors. So it's like, you're going to need to put up $1 million in like as a bail bond. To cover those costs. And they said that was too steep a price. So they started counting on Monday. And even that, they didn't give up, though. They actually had 100 Democrat lawyers come back again and try to stop this recount. And they had another judge. The first judge had to recuse himself after they found out he had some sort of connection to a Republican. he met one once, but it's... but then even the second judge came out on Wednesday and said that no, this can continue, which made Donald Trump pretty happy. He actually commented on the situation on Wednesday after that second ruling, where he said on some social media post that hasn't kicked him off yet that it's a big victory today in Arizona. A highly respected judge has just ruled that the forensic audit being done by the Arizona State Senate can and will continue. Over 100 Democrat lawyers were sent to fight against this audit. The result will be very interesting for the USA and the world to see. And so, yeah, they've got this big judge ruling. They'll continue counting. Like I said, 2.1 million ballots by hand is quite the process. I've never counted that high before, but it's
going to take a while. But the margin of error or the margin of victory for Biden is quite small. This is very much within the realm of this could overturn this county, which could have pretty wide-reaching implications.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the margin for victory for Biden in the entire state is barely over 10,000 votes. So I mean, and then you're going through 2 million that you just need a fairly small percentage. And as one of the Republican officials from Arizona said, that there were actually quite a few ballots that they had some sort of problem with the voting machine that they couldn't have been read, and so they just had to have some official on election night make a judgment of who they thought those ballots were for. Mm. And so they said that could be quite interesting to actually have someone like sit down and like physically read out each ballot.
Yeah,
that there's a good chance that could switch. And then the media is already talking about that this is a Republican attempt to overturn the
right
election, which means that they're they're pretty concerned about what they might find. But I mean, this is actually One American News is televising this whole thing, so it's definitely transparent, much more transparent than what happened on election night.
Yeah. Well, we don't know what's going to happen here. We don't know exactly how this prophecy is going to be fulfilled, but our editor-in-chief is very insistent. President Trump will return to power based on those prophecies that he is he's looking at, and he has written another article for the print edition of The Trumpet that we just sent out, sent to the press yesterday. So you can watch for that. That should be up on the website next week. And it is very interesting. We'll keep our eyes on what's happening in Arizona. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. China has been on a roll with its Belt and Road project. This week, Australia put a bit of a roadblock in these plans. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Wednesday, Australia pulled out of two major agreements that it had made with China that were part of the Belt and Road initiative. So the Belt and Road, just to give a little background information here, it's China's program to build this huge network of road and rail and ports and all kinds of other infrastructure. It's a globe-girdling network that goes through Asia, across the Middle East, then down into Africa, and up into Europe. It even has extensions into Latin America. At an estimated cost of $5 trillion, it is believed to be the most ambitious infrastructure venture in all of history. And of course, it has an overarching goal of giving China dominance over world trade. So this is a project that has benefited some nations, at least in the short term, but it is also being seen more and more as a predatory program in which China kind of buys its way into countries and then takes advantage of them in various ways. Sometimes China is even ensnaring countries into giving it control over some of their national assets. So more and more people are waking up to the dangers of this Chinese program, and the leaders of Australia, to their credit, they are coming to see that as well, and they're pulling out. So the foreign minister actually overrode these deals that had been made by the state of Victoria. And China has been just fuming over this. You know, relations between China and Australia had already been very strained over the last year or so, and this is now bringing them to a new low.
How do you expect this to go forward? Certainly, Australia is putting itself in a position to suffer some economically, but they're looking at the broader geopolitical issues at stake here. China has quite a few weapons to use in trying to punish Australia. How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, well, I think that Australia is finally beginning to see that their security is more important than short-term economic benefits. And so they're making some decisions that are tough, and it is sure to bring some economic downturn to the Australians. But I think it's definitely the right call.
Yeah.
And prophetically, we've really expected Australia to not remain a part of China's Belt and Road initiative. And that's because the Bible talks about a multinational trade alliance that will form in the modern era. Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 show that this trade alliance will include China and Europe, also Russia and Japan. And these countries will end up dominating world trade for a time, and they'll use that dominance to block what the Bible calls the nations of Israel out of world trade. And that phrase, nations of Israel, it means the countries that formed from the descendants of Jacob, or Israel, the grandson of Abraham. But this term in prophecies like these mainly describes the end time United States and Britain. Listeners can prove that by ordering a free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And of course, we know that Australia came out of the United Kingdom. It's one of the Commonwealth nations. So when that multinational trade alliance, headed up by China and Europe and Japan, takes shape and starts blocking and besieging other nations, it looks like the Belt and Road Initiative could be a significant part of how they accomplish that. So we really wouldn't have expected Australia to remain aligned with China within that framework. we would expect, based on prophecy, a rift between Australia and China to emerge. And that's exactly what's been happening, not just with this Belt and Road Initiative cancellation, but also with the serious trade and political frictions that have been just soaring over the last couple of months. So I think this is all going just how we would expect, based on Bible prophecy.
Where would you send people for more information if they were interested?
We have an article by our own Andrew Miller. It's called China's Plan to Surround Australia, which would be a good starting point. And then also a booklet by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, called Isaiah's End Time Vision, which goes through a much more in-depth look.
All right. Well, thank you, Jeremiah. One last story. China took an impressive leap into space this week. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, China has launched the first module of their new space station. It's an ambitious step for their space program. And most of the time, or a lot of times, some of these different milestones in space can be interesting scientifically, exciting even. But as far as the nation is concerned, a national power, they're prestige projects. You know, they boost the morale of the nation. They show how great they are. But it may be not of huge practical purpose. With China's space station, that is not the case. There are a lot of practical implications of this. I mean, the first is, you know, China is kind of billing this as a cooperative thing. They're billing people to come, you know, work with us. We know what that means with China. That means come give us an opportunity to steal all of your technology. So this is a Chinese bid to use this to kind of hoover up other people's tech to catch up. There's even been talk, I don't know how serious it is, of potentially Russia taking off its part from the International Space Station and going and joining the Chinese space station instead. I'm not sure if that's even possible. Like I said, I think it's just fairly loose talk. But then also, you know, space is becoming an increasingly important battleground. This is where communications are sent. This is where reconnaissance happens. This, if you want to control battles on the Earth, you want to control space. And you know, China has already demonstrated this. They demonstrated that they could shoot down American satellites by shooting down one of their own satellites several years ago, creating masses of space junk in the process. One of the things that they're talking about for this space station, they're now China actually says that they're incredibly concerned about the problem of space junk and that they want to fit a laser onto their space station. Now, don't worry, this is not a Chinese Death Star. They won't be vaporizing your house anytime soon. They're saying it's to kind of sweep up space junk. That's just, but it could very easily be used to target American satellites. And actually, America considered putting a laser in space to clean up space junk and decided against it because they thought they would be accused of putting weapons into space. So this is something that does have a very practical implications for down here on Earth.
Well, that's an interesting point that you make, the difference between the United States and China's approach to actually exploiting the military potential of space. Certainly, China doesn't seem to have any compunction about doing that.
No, and I think it's interesting because there are some Bible prophecies about how some of these future battles take place. Ezekiel chapter 7 and verse 14, for example, describes a situation where it says they've blown forth the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes forth to the battle. And trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has drawn attention to this and talked about how you could have cyber warfare disrupting America's defense capabilities so much that this is the case. There's kind of the alarm is raised, but nobody acts because the whole kind of command and control infrastructure has been disrupted. You can see space doing a similar thing. This is what you need to spot threats coming. This is what you need to communicate the existence of those threats to your troops. And it is becoming something, you know, the French soldiers, after serving alongside American soldiers, when they kind of went back to working alone, they had to work quite hard to unlearn some of this space dependence. So you could see how you could have a similar kind of effect by crippling America's space infrastructure. And I actually wrote an article on this several years ago in our Trumpet Print magazine. This was in the February 2016 issue, called Space, the Final Military Frontier, talking about the role, the importance that space weapons can play, and how that they could play into some of these Bible prophecies. And certainly, God says that America's military and all the efforts that they're putting into defending themselves aren't going to prosper while the nation is rebelling against him and his laws.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Cicero: a thankful heart is not only the greatest virtue, but the parent of all other virtues. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.